This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Nancy Princenthal. She is a contributing editor at Art in America. She teaches at the School of Visual Arts, and she's author of the new book, Agnes Martin, Her Life and Art. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, Agnes Martin was an abstract painter. She's a New Mexico artist, although she was not born here. She spent much of her life here. We kind of claim her as our own here in New Mexico. How did you first become aware of her work, and how did you come to write a book about her?
I first became aware of her work as a teenager in New York. I saw her work at the Museum of Modern Art here in New York, where I grew up. But I didn't have the opportunity to write about it or to give it much devoted thought until I was in college. And at that time, when it came time for me to write a senior thesis, I decided that she was going to be my subject. And as part of that exercise, I wrote to her, and she wrote back. So that planted that correspondence, and also the writing of the thesis, planted a seed that kind of took a long time to germinate.
What was it about her work that spoke to you as a teenager?
It's a little bit hard for me to reconstruct what my responses were like as a teenager, but I think it was the combination of work that I felt to be challenging in its simplicity and its austerity, and at the same time, and to the same extent, inexplicably welcoming. There was something about it that drew me in that I couldn't quite explain. I've come to think of that, and I know I'm not alone in this response, as representing the, on one hand, the beauty of it, but also the sort of ineffable presence of the artist's hand.
Which is so strange and ironic, because so much of her work is very, very linear, the grids and stripes, that you wonder if what is the presence of the artist's hand in that kind of presentation.
It's very visible when you come up close to the canvases. You can see the progress of the pencil across the surface. The pencil line remains in the work from the early 1960s, when she began developing the language that she would be associated with, right through to the end of her career and of her life. She painted almost until the end of her life in 2004. So that sort of written painting aspect of her work, the fact that she always had a pencil in her hand, and indeed you can also see that uneven nature of some of the brushwork in her later paintings is evidence of a person at work. It's not a mechanically executed kind of painting at all. But you can also feel it when you step away. There's something about the way the field of those square paintings is never quite still. There's a luminosity to them and a vibrancy that I think is also evidence of a sensibility at work.
The way Agnes Martin spoke about her art and her work, I think, would make it kind of tricky for a biographer. I mean, she didn't seem to believe, from what you presented in your own book, in the value of ideas, in intellectual thinking, in nonfiction, even in biography. She asked friends not to talk about her after she was gone. What do you do with that when your task is to actually do a lot of those things that she didn't believe in?
It's a very good question, and indeed that gave me pause. You know, I've done a number of readings in which I've included the last pages of the book, and I always get a laugh when I read in those circumstances from a letter that she wrote to me, the letter that she wrote to me when I was an undergraduate, in which she says, you must not consider an artist's biography. You must not consider ideas. Ideas have nothing to do with artwork. And above all, you must never speak to critics. You must have no contact with critics. And of course, I've spent my professional life as a critic, not really as a biographer. But knowing that, I also felt that there was an important story to be told, despite what she said. And in fact, it's often important when trying to come to terms with an artist's work and to explain your responses to others so that those responses can be shared, to take the work itself as the invitation to guide your thoughts rather than necessarily what the artist said or wrote about them. And I thought there were important ideas that she put forward that could be explored and shared. And also I thought, as I got more involved in the project, that there are aspects of her life that had a bearing on her work that were also important to get out there into the public realm, have a discussion about.
Now, she moved to New York City in the 1950s. Talk about her relationship with New York artists of that era. How do you think they affected her work, and her work affected theirs?
Enormously. She didn't arrive in New York in 1957 as a complete naive. She had been working at that point for more than a decade in roughly a decade in New Mexico, which on the one hand is quite remote from the cultural capitals of the time, but on the other hand was a lively community of artists, both local artists and visiting artists from both coasts and indeed from Europe and beyond. So, and she had spent a fair amount of time intermittently in New York. She went to Teachers College, where she got a teaching degree with a major in visual arts. So she had the opportunity to be exposed to a fair amount of modern art, of vanguard art of the period. At the same time, that decade that she spent in New York was enormously important. Her neighbors included Ellsworth Kelly, Jack Youngerman, Robert Indiana, Eleanor Tawney, Ann Wilson, all people who had really important exchanges with Agnes Martin. I think it's also important to note that by the time she came to New York, she was 45 years old. And although she wasn't fully developed as an artist, she was so poised to make the leaps that she made when she was here. And a lot of the artists she associated with here in New York, especially those down at Coenti Slip, the Seaport area where she lived and worked, were younger than her. And so the influences were quite mutual. I think she was a very powerful presence down there, and all of the artists down there were really developing quickly at that time.
Now, she destroyed much of her early work, mm-hmm. and we still have some of it. How do you see her early work, and how do you think it led to what she did and became so famous for?
In a progression that honestly is not completely at odds with the more or less standard progression of artists of her generation. She was born in 1912. She's of the generation of the abstract expressionists. And many of those artists went through this long period of sort of feeling their way toward the development of what became radical languages, for all of them, forms of radical abstraction. So the very early work, which has been shown at the Harwood Museum in a show that went to the Albright Knox, and has been included in a catalog that, you know, the figurative portraits and still life landscapes, I think those were all positions through which artists of her generation did very frequently move. She was absorbing the lessons of her era and responding to artists that she had access to at that time, either in reproduction or in life, from John Marin to Paul Klee. And then similarly, when her work became increasingly abstract in a sort of slow progress toward full abstraction. She moved through a number of surrealist-influenced styles, including a kind of biomorphic abstraction that she continued to work in for a brief period after she came to New York. And she's also not completely alone in the effort to frame her career as having sort of arrived full-blown. Many artists look back on early work and say, you know, don't let that get out into the public. I think it's quite a common response in all disciplines, that sort of fear of being identified by work that on mature reflection doesn't seem fully cooked. But of course, we who are interested in Martin's work would love to see more of the early work, and indeed some of the early work, not the figurative work, but the early assemblages are included in this show that's now at the Tate in London and will be traveling.
So what was it, in your view, about the work that she did and that she's known for, the grids and the stripes, that held her passion and that of her viewers for so many decades?
You know, the way she talked about her work is quite distinctive and very compelling. And so in answer to what held her attention, there is this curious perspective that her writing and her public talks offered. And what she said about her work was that when she first began to paint the grid, her work started to come to her as a form of inspiration in which she would see each painting in her mind's eye, full-blown in every detail, but postage stamp size. So her job as an artist was to execute these inspirations, and that meant simply blowing them up to this 6-foot square that she felt was the size they needed to be, so you would have this experience of a sort of full-body immersion in the work. In slightly more open-ended terms, the kind that we as viewers can respond to, she also identified with the abstract expressionist, not just by age, but also by disposition, in the sense that what she wanted to achieve with the work was the expression of universal emotional states, universal states of happiness, of calm, of joy, of innocence. Innocence in particular was something she came to feel very strongly about. It's clear to most of her viewers, I share this, that that experience is an experience that is very similar to the one so many people find in nature and that she found in nature. So there is a quality to the paintings, to their light, to their color, when they began to include more color, that I think can be associated with the experience of the landscape, and in particular with the landscape of New Mexico, where she spent so much of her life. It's also, I think, not unrelated to the landscape of her earliest childhood, which was in Saskatchewan, on in the prairies of central Saskatchewan, Canada.
You write, interestingly, about the prairies of Saskatchewan and how really difficult to impossible they are to photograph.
Yes, that was a surprise. I was disappointed, actually. I went up there hoping to come back with documentation of what the relationship between her paintings and that landscape was, and I looked at what I had and I thought, this can't be reproduced. There's nothing
right
here. It's just, you know, it's just a lot of moving air, big beautiful sky, and rather nondescript land. But when you're there, the experience is quite powerful and so beautiful, which is of course very similar to her paintings, many of which, especially the earliest grids, are practically impossible to reproduce in a way that conveys anything about their power.
Right, right, exactly. Yeah, I mean, the experience that I've had seeing them, it kind of fluctuates between I'm looking at graph paper and I'm looking at truth and beauty. And I think even you have had that experience, because you write at the very end that when you started to write this book, you went back to one of her paintings that had moved you and it had gone dead for you, and then it came alive again.
That was a scary experience, and and I think it's also a really helpful one. And I think, you know, for most of us, it's important to accept that that is always lurking in the wings. And I think it's important to put work to the test in that sense. Am I sure that this connection is happening? Am I sure that there is this live line that's going between me and the painting or whatever the object is that I'm looking at? And what's its nature? What is it about this relationship that is kindling something in me, the viewer, or, you know, that did kindle something in the artist who made it? So it's an active thing. I think that our relationship to artwork is always changing, even when we go back and back to the works that we most love.
We're talking to Nancy Princenthal about her new book, Agnes Martin, Her Life and Art. Agnes Martin read a lot of Eastern spiritual texts, and her work seems to have been deeply influenced by them, although she may not have wanted us or her viewers to really see it that way. But are these Eastern texts for you a lens through which to view her work?
I think that aspects of Zen Buddhism, Taoism, were very important to Martin at various stages in her life. It's possible but speculative that she was exposed to that influence when she was quite young, and when she was in her early 20s and living in the Pacific Northwest in an area around Bellingham, Washington. She might have been exposed to those influences if she participated at all in the cultural scene in Seattle at that time, which was very lively. I think that that might be clarified by research that's going on now. There's actually a fair amount of active exploration of Martin's work, and I think new material is still coming to light. She certainly was exposed to Eastern influences when she was living in Taos in the 40s and 50s. Again, that was a community that was very alert to influences coming from Asia. The West Coast in general and the West was more ready to absorb those influences sooner than artists living in New York were. But certainly by the time she got to New York, and artists like John Cage, who was so involved with Zen Buddhism, were also having a powerful effect on the artists down at the South Street Seaport, that would come to play in her work. At the same time, I don't think it's helpful to have a one-to-one relationship, look for a one-to-one relationship between Buddhism and her painting. I think it was appealing to her as a route to a kind of calm, a kind of serenity, which were states that she yearned for very actively, sometimes with some difficulty.
Now, she was diagnosed paranoid schizophrenic. How did that manifest in her life, and if it did, in her work?
Paranoid schizophrenia is a pretty serious diagnosis, and there are a couple of ways to answer that. The simplest is it was mostly just a challenge to get beyond. She was hospitalized several times, and during the periods when she was most ill, she didn't work. I think that's the nature of the illness. It can be very disabling. At the same time, she sort of fought her way through it, even in periods when it was under control. It was never uh, it it was never absent from her character or her life. She did hear voices. And I think managing the inner disruption, both aural hallucinations and the sense of isolation, and what she described quite openly in her writing is as a feeling of terror. She sought solitude, and yet she found being alone at times quite horrible, you know, quite disorienting and miserable. So I think it is possible to see her work not as a symptom of her illness or as a way of curing it, of expiating it, but possibly instead as a way of regulating her sensory experience. Even that is putting it a little bit too much in terms of a kind of symptomatic response, but I think there is that connection. And it's a connection, by the way, that I think artists who were, otherwise considered quite healthy or are considered quite healthy feel about making art, that it's a way of channeling your experience of the sensory world into a system of mark making that exercises some order and beauty over it. You know, beauty being a sort of network you can throw over disorganized experience.
I was thinking as I was reading the book, I mean, there's this kind of ongoing maybe tension or dialectic between, on the one hand, doing what you do, which is being a scholar and a critic and a writer, and on the other hand, doing what Agnes Martin wanted her viewers to do, which is go for that true feeling and that direct, unmediated experience of art, where if you were to really do that, you maybe wouldn't write a book at all. And I was wondering what it's like for you, having written the book now. Do you feel like you understand her and her work better? Do you feel like the truth is still best found without all of that?
It's a good question. Yes, and yes and no. I'm going to honor the sort of paradox that question presents. It's been fascinating to I won't even say to fill in blanks, but to discover whole areas of her life that I never suspected. And when I was in college, the fact that her romantic relationships in the 50s were mostly, in the 60s were mostly with women, that it's probably accurate to describe her as a lesbian, none of that would have been talked about, nor ever would her mental illness have been talked about. Those things were really kept under wraps during her life. The biographical aspects of all artists' lives were considered off-limits for serious criticism. If you were talking about work, you were just talking about things that could be seen in the work without reaching beyond it. Not just to biography, but, to the social and historical conditions of the context in which it was made. So that's really undergone a sea change. Probably has gone too far in terms of criticism and art history being in the business now, much more of thinking about the work through all those lenses, through the biographical lens, the cultural lens, the social lens, the political lens. So I do feel, that there's way more license now, and I think it's legitimate to consider all of the factors that go into making a work of art. There is the danger of having the work demystified, or of having the person, sort of falsely demystified. And I think one of the challenges when you get deeply involved in someone's work like that is to hold on to that mystery. It's there as a goal, to hold on to that understanding that as much as we know about someone's work and the motivation for it, much as we as we think we understand where it came from and what it does to us, there's something in that mix that we're never going to be able to really capture.
Nancy Princenthal is author of the new book, Agnes Martin, Her Life and Work, published by Thames and Hudson. I want to thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.